Actually, a colleague of mine has described ransomware operators and their affiliates as vultures rather than eagles. So they're not honing in on these big organizations they can target. They're really kind of picking the bones. They were trying to work out what they can access and then exploit it.
Hi, I'm Marianne Bohrer with HIMSS. Today I'm sitting down with Tim Mitchell, Senior Security Researcher and Intel Analysis Lead for Cybercrime at SecureWorks. Today we'll be talking about the ransomware ecosystem, operators, affiliates, and access brokers. But before we start, I'd like to say thank you to SecureWorks for sponsoring this podcast. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Marianne. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
Yeah, certainly. So as you said, I'm a security researcher at SecureWorks, specifically in the counter threat unit. And I focus on cybercrime intelligence as the assessment lead. I've been at SecureWorks now for around 7 years. And prior to that, I worked for the National Crime Agency, which is the UK equivalent of the FBI, but with a much, much smaller budget, as I'm sure your listeners will understand. And I worked in a number of various disciplines over 12 years or so in or around cybercrime. So that means in total, I've been looking at this kind of stuff for about 15 years. And when I started out in cybercrime, incidentally, banks didn't really even have cybersecurity departments because it just wasn't really a problem they cared about. So that's me in a nutshell.
Wow. So what is ransomware as a service? And when did that start?
So I suppose the exact time is fairly difficult to pin down because it was kind of a gradual evolution rather than sort of a step change in the way operations took place. But we probably first saw it in the mid-2010s, although we think it probably began in earnest around about 5 years ago. In terms of ransomware as a service specifically, it's probably helpful if I describe the evolution from the traditional kind of ransomware scheme. So traditional ransomware was always a kind of core group of individuals who developed and deployed ransomware on victim networks and then extorted payment. But there are obvious limitations to that model, not least in how many victims a small group of individuals can hit and monetize those intrusions. So it made sense to then farm out elements of that process to third parties, which enabled the scaling of operations. And that obviously in turn resulted in specialisms, so with criminal associates performing specific roles in support of the extortion. So you have the core group of individuals effectively that develop the ransomware, but other people will then access networks and deploy it. And that's really a kind of ransomware as a service, a group of people that are paying for the ransomware operators for that particular tool.
You know, I thought that was fascinating. It's quite different to what most people think. You know, you kind of picture one hacker alone in a room and not kind of this organization behind it. So can you tell us a little bit about the components in this ecosystem?
Yeah, so as I've mentioned, the core group, the operators and the developers of the ransomware. So what that means is they create the ransomware, they maintain it, they make improvements, they add innovations. And obviously, in the traditional operations, this core group did everything. So that included gaining access to networks and deploying the ransomware. And it's important to know that some groups do still operate in that way. So it's not all the ransomware scene is not all now ransomware as a service. There are some groups that still operate as private groups. They hit a few victims each month, but obviously that's enough for them to generate revenue. So in the ransomware as a service, you also have affiliates, otherwise known as partners. And that was the way that the changes really started to come into the ransomware scene, as I said, about 5 years ago. So to spread risk to other individuals and scale the operations, as I've said, some ransomware groups did start to work with those partners or affiliates. And actually, they advertised their partner programs on underground forums, and they say, we need people to come and provide these functions for us. So in the ransomware as a service world, those affiliates gain access to a network, or they buy access to the network on an underground forum, and then they position and deploy that ransomware for maximum impact. The operators, so the original core group, then engage with a victim negotiation, so in order to get the maximum amount of money they can from that ransomware deployment. And it is important to note that affiliates actually take the lion's share of the ransom. Most schemes offer their affiliates or partners between 70 and 90% of the total ransomware payment, so it's quite significant. And I think that's probably because those affiliates actually take on most of the risk. They're the ones that are engaging on a victim network, and they're exposing themselves ultimately to more scrutiny than the people that develop and distribute the ransomware. And then the third component of the ecosystem are the initial access brokers. We refer to those as IABs. And as the name suggests, they obtain access and then sell it on to the ransomware operators or affiliates for a set price. And the cost of that access likely depends on the nature of the organization that's been targeted and the level of privilege of the access gained. So for example, an administrator login at a large high revenue organization is likely to cost a lot more than the login details for a general user at a small lower revenue organization.
Well, that makes sense. Now, Tim, can you give us some real world examples of operators, affiliates, and access brokers in the ransomware ecosystem?
Yeah, certainly. So probably your listeners will have heard of Lockbit ransomware just because it's arguably the most prolific since it emerged around about 2 years ago now. And this is a group we track as Gold Mystic. They obviously have a very large number of affiliators, and we consider them to be the core group of operators. So they, as I've said, they develop the ransomware, they make it available to their affiliates, and they negotiate with victims. So as an affiliate example, I'll talk about Gold Matador. And I should probably have said that in SecureWorks, we apply two-word prefix to the groups that we track. And Gold is the attribution we give to cybercrime groups. So obviously all these groups are engaged in cybercrime, so they're Gold, then the name. So in this case, Gold Matador. And this group is an affiliate of the Hive ransomware as a service scheme. They gain access through things like remote access services, like virtual private network connections and remote desktop protocol. And then once they're on the network, they look to deploy Hive ransomware through lateral movement, deployment of other tools, harvest credentials, and then ultimately deploy the ransomware, ideally from a location like a domain controller, which is obviously somewhere that they can distribute the ransomware more widely to have the greatest impact. And then also on the affiliate side, we have a group called Gold Hideaway. And it's important to mention this is probably one of the more interesting elements of the ransomware as a service ecosystem, is that these affiliates are not tied to any one group. So they might work with one ransomware family 1 week and then move to another ransomware family the next week. And in this case, we have a group called Gold Hideaway. And we saw evidence in mid-2021 that they deployed Reval ransomware on a particular victim. And then once the Reval ransomware disappeared briefly, they actually then moved on to Lockbit and started deploying Lockbit on victim networks. And then the third element of the ecosystem, specific example I'll give is of Gold Melody. And this group, they gain access to networks and then obviously sell it to ransomware operators. They do attempt to enumerate the network and escalate privileges before selling it on, because as I've said, if they just sold their initial access, it might have lower value than if they're able to gain access to a network, navigate around that network, find better credentials, admin credentials to various specific systems. So they try and do that before they then sell on that access. And there is one final kind of element of the initial access brokers group that's more of a kind of automated process, and that's botnet operators. So botnets, things like Quackbot, Imotet, what they do is they obviously spam completely aimlessly random victims, and that might lead to the delivery of malware through a phishing attempt, and then that might well be sold on to a ransomware affiliate or an operator in order to deploy ransomware.
Now, Tim, how does knowing who these groups are play a role in creating countermeasures?
It's less probably about knowing who they are as it is knowing what their intentions are once you know who they are. And then also the tools that they use to meet their objectives. I mean, that is hugely important, because that allows us to create those countermeasures based on their behaviors and their indicators. But the important thing is to add meaningful context. You know, we often hear stories of network defenders at specific organizations really struggling with the amount of alerts that automated systems generate. And it's actually that context that elevates an alert to a point where someone just knows they need to have a look at it. So a really good example of that is the Gold Matador group that I mentioned earlier. And in four separate intrusions, we saw them use the same virtual machine to conduct their activity. And what I mean by that is a threat actor, in this case, obviously a cyber criminal, they'll gain access to a network. They won't use their own computer because it leaves too many footprints. So they use a virtual machine that they've created that enables them to access that network theoretically anonymously. However, in the case of this group, we saw them use the same virtual machine to conduct their activity on four separate intrusions. So as a result of that, we can create a countermeasure based on the host name of that virtual machine. So when we identify that in future on a customer network and that's alerted, that context really helps the customer react, because they know that if that host name has been observed on that on a device or on that network, they know that it's a high priority alert that needs to be addressed, because just around the corner there could be a high ransomware deployment. And it's that very short window of opportunity that could make the difference between blocking a threat actor off a network and preventing ransomware, and actually having a really bad day in the office where an entire network is completely wiped out. In addition to that, of course, that knowledge helps our incident response teams. So when they're armed with that kind of insight, they're able to give the best advice they can on the correct course of action during an engagement. And it also helps guide that investigation. So if we know that we've seen this specific indicator or this specific behavior that relates to a threat group, they can then go and look for evidence of activity that might be associated with that, and also give them assurance that they can take the right steps to ultimately evict that threat actor from the network and protect that customer from future intrusions from that group.
I see. Now, how can organizations protect themselves from these bad actors?
Well, as with most cyber threats, prevention is the best kind of remedy. I think it's probably especially so where ransomware is concerned, just because it can be so damaging. And it's important really here to point out that we think for the most part, ransomware groups are opportunistic. There are maybe a few that target specific verticals based on their assessment that some will pay. But that targeting doesn't really come immediately. It's a triage process. And actually, a colleague of mine has described ransomware operators and their affiliates as vultures rather than eagles. So they're not honing in on these big organizations they can target. They're really kind of picking the bones. They were trying to work out what they can access and then exploit it. So the important thing is that these ransomware groups and anyone in that ecosystem, they really kind of gain access by one of two ways. So they either scan for vulnerabilities and exploit them. So they use a tool called Shodan, which your listeners may have heard of, that kind of assesses the internet effectively, does port scanning and looks for software versions that might be vulnerable to specific vulnerabilities. And once they've scanned those networks, they'll then look to exploit those vulnerabilities. The alternative is they use stolen credentials, so that those credentials can be stolen through phishing, or they might be delivered through botnets like Imatek and Quackbot that I've already mentioned, in order to infect machines. Or they may even buy those credentials in underground forums. So those are the two methods. So thinking about those two things is then, well, what mitigations can an organization put in place that helps prevent against that kind of activity? So once that an access is gained, they might then triage to find the best organization to target or which action to follow up on. So an organization really needs to think that anyone can be at risk effectively, and it's more about the exposures than it is what they're actually involved in. So with that in mind, I would say there are three core elements to prevention. So the first one is to really ensure that you've got a good patch management strategy. So that means you're aware of your external facing services and that those external facing services are running software that's up to date. So is not vulnerable to the kind of vulnerabilities that we know these groups exploit. That really is the best remedy against that. And it's quite clear that ransomware groups, they'll do scanning. If they don't find a vulnerability on the network, there's nothing for them to exploit. So they just move on to the next one. I think it really is that simple. The second one on the credentials side, to avoid the exploitation of stolen credentials, is to think about multi-factor authentication and deploying that robustly and widely across your network. And to think about a solution that actually provides a kind of more robust way of checking against that kind of activity, because we know there are certain groups that are able to circumvent some kinds of MFA. So there's one kind that will send, and I imagine some of your listeners have come across this kind of thing where there's a push notification to a mobile device and the person just clicks yes. That's good. It's better than not having it at all, but that in some circumstance can be circumvented, which enables the threat actor to gain access to a network. So you're better off going for one that actually requires some kind of user input. So for example, code matching. So an application will generate a code number, and then the individual has to then input that code into the MFA alert in order for access to be granted. So that's the second element that helps protect organizations from ransomware. And the third really is endpoint monitoring. You know, I touched earlier on the idea of identifying precursor activity, because very often, you know, if you've detected the ransomware, it's probably too late. You need to identify the things that are occurring before that ransomware deployment, which comes back to the whole why it's important to understand the intentions of the group that are doing this, so you can see what's coming down the track. And the way to do that is with an endpoint detection solution, preferably extended, so you get the contextual alerts, or even managed, so you get a team of experts to kind of provide that monitoring for you, and then can say, yeah, this alert is serious. You need to take action here because this is coming down the road. So those are really the three core elements, I would say, that an organization needs to think about to protect themselves properly from this threat.
Well, that kind of leads into my next question, which is, what do you tell an organization that has already been compromised?
It's really important early on to engage an expert incident response team. You know, if you know that you've been compromised, and even at any level, you know, if you identify, you know, you do some work on an initial alert and you realize that actually there's a real threat here from ransomware, it's important to engage experts immediately, because they'll be able to advise you in a scoping call on any action you might immediately be able to take. So that, for example, might mean shutting down an affected device, or more likely it might mean attempts to contain it, so isolate a host from a network. You don't necessarily want to shut it down, that doesn't always work, but certainly isolating it will be a more valuable piece of advice to give. And then you need obviously a thorough investigation to determine the root cause, because you want to ensure the threat actor is evicted from the network, and you also want to ideally take steps to prevent that kind of activity in future. So for example, if in the course of an investigation you determine that a particular vulnerability was exploited, well, you really want to make sure that you close off that vulnerability so that the external facing service that exposed that is properly up to date, or you even use a different solution, potentially one that's deemed more secure. So really it's about engagement with incident response. We have a link on our own homepage at secureworks.com called Experiencing a Breach, and that gives you a global hotline number, and I believe that's answered 24/7. And obviously other providers also do that. And it's kind of that's just the key part of the process. Get expert advice as soon as you can to kind of really contain and mitigate the threat at the earliest possible stage before it becomes really damaging.
That's excellent advice. And Tim, where can listeners go to get specific information if they'd like to know more about this?
Yep. So I mentioned the SecureWorks website. That's a good resource. There are blogs about ransomware threat and details of the kind of readiness testing that help organizations effectively plan for attacks like this. And I think that is an important thing to do. You know, at the time a ransomware incident happens, you don't want that to be the first you're aware it could happen, and then be scrabbling around and try and work out a plan of action to deal with it. It's really important to put a plan in place, understand what you will do should you fall victim to a ransomware attack, who your experts are, who you go to. It's even sensible to think about setting up an incident response retainer, so you basically buy hours in advance from a particular ransomware provider, and they'll be on hand to help you should the worst happen. If you want to know more about the specifics of this kind of activity, so the ransomware as a service stuff, I recommend the presentation I gave at the SecureWorks TI Summit, and all of those presentations are now online. There's some really good content there from other people, including some other ransomware presentations, but also some really interesting advanced persistent threat research. And again, you can find that on the website. I think it requires an email to register for it, but you get access to all of the content from that day, which I think is really, really valuable. And it will give you a lot more detail about what I've spoken about with you today.
Fantastic. Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights. And a special thanks to SecureWorks for sponsoring this podcast. Have a terrific rest of your day.
Thanks, Marianne. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.